You are listening to a sermon recorded in 2006 at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Welcome, everybody. This is an unusual service for those of you who are here the first time. It's not usual to have so many people here, for one thing. The other thing that's unusual is we usually have somebody who's qualified to speak. But Evan was leading the singing today instead. So. Mind you, I was told I had to come up with something for about 20, 25 minutes, and since Evan did four songs with five-minute introductions, I only have to go for five. But thank you very much. It's wonderful to hear so many voices singing, and it's wonderful to have Evan and Ruth leading us. Some of those songs just made my hair stand on end, not that you'd notice. Anyways, 2 weeks ago I was asked if I would do the children's story, and I was told that I'd have to disguise it as a sermon, but to make it an extra long story, which is okay. I mean, that's what I usually do. Most people here know me as the children's story guy, and I'm used to it. It's what I do every week, and people are used to seeing me up here. Also, stories come easily to me. It's a talent that I don't take for granted. It's likely that I'm more amazed than the kids are with the stories, because their experience is different than mine. And their experience is they trot up to the front, they sit on their little rug, and somebody gives them a story. My experience is I trot in here and sometime between the first hymn and when the children's feature is announced, I come up with a story. Most of the time I come to church, I do not have a story. And, you know, in 5 to 10 minutes I come up with a story, I'm amazed. It's a miracle. And even though I create most of the stories I tell, but not all, they're not really my stories. Each one of them has some part that's outside of me. And it might be something that one of you said to me once, or perhaps something I saw one of the children doing, or something that my sons taught me. I don't feel like a master storyteller. I feel more like I am the servant of the stories. Now, after the service, I'm often surprised when people come to me and they'll congratulate me on the insightful and concise parts of the story, the great wisdom. They credit me with a lot of intelligence on that. The fact is that I think it's often the wisdom of the listener that ferrets out the incisiveness or ferrets out the spirituality of these stories. I'm afraid I can't take credit for a lot of that. The Lord gives me these stories, and I believe that our Creator has made inside of us a deep-rooted desire to hear, use, and learn from stories. Stories are powerful. The power of stories is actually omnidirectional. One listener can feel, perhaps, that the power comes as a new insight on the scriptures. And another might feel that the power is a new spirituality, a new view on spirituality. I'm very amazed how often the stories develop a power of their own and teach different people different wisdom. Stories are powerful, and like any device of power, people like to play with them. People like to play with powerful things. Often people look at Jesus' parables and they say, It's a simple story. And yet, you know, his stories just seize you. They're pointed. They're almost terrible in their clarity. And so people will say, well, you know, I could do that. Simple thing. Of course, you know, we're talking about something Jesus did, and it's not necessarily easy to replicate that, but people try. In fact, Martin Luther, he has this book, or had written this book, called Table Talk. Some of you probably studied that book. And I have a quote from that, because I just really liked what he had to say. He has this to say about the art of the story. To play with allegories in Christian doctrine is dangerous. The words sound well and smoothly, but they have no purpose. They serve well for such preachers that have not studied much. Preachers who know not rightly how to expound the histories and texts, these resort to allegories, wherein nothing is taught certainly on which a man may build. He's harsh on stories. He gives examples of allegories of stories that he's heard. And, you know, studying them and looking at them, and they're translated from German, so they're a little rough to read for me, but when he shows some of these examples, they are rather fantastic when you consider the plain message that they're built on. And it seems that in those days, allegories filled with eagles, virgins, and dragons, they were often used as devices to entertain from the pulpit rather than to enlighten. Something like perhaps our previous generation's over-emotional pulpit-thumping sermons. They were entertaining, but often scripturally thin. And since weeping from the pulpit is no longer in style, present congregations have turned to the invention of the generation, the computer. And if Luther were writing today, I'm sure he would be railing not against allegories, but PowerPoint presentations. Now, I've been telling children's stories since I was 15. And that's when I discovered that the ability to tell a story was a priceless tool for a babysitter. During all those years, 52 now, I've lost count of the number of times that people have asked me, where do you get the ideas for these stories? People are always interested. How did you come up with that? And it's a good question. It's an honest question. But the funny part of it all is that I don't know. You've probably heard me joke when you've asked me that, you know, they're divinely inspired. But lately I think the joke's on me, because really, where does all creativity come from? Now, I might not know where all of these stories come from, but I do know that my stories teach me things. I learn from my stories. I learn all over again just how foolish I can be. I learn all over again how easy it is to lie to myself. I learn how selfish I can be. And I also learn how good life can be. I learn that we have the power to make life good. Now, everybody knows what a story is, but rarely do we think about what a story does. Parables, folk tales, and fables. When we use these words, we know what's coming. If somebody says, "Let me tell you a fable," you know you're going to get some kind of a lesson or advice. Someone says to you, "Well, that reminds me of a parable." Well, you know what's coming. You know some moral or spiritual judgment is going to be delivered on you. And if someone in a group, you know, you're discussing as a group, you're trying to come up with some sort of decision, somebody says, "Reminds me of a folktale." Well, what that tells you is this guy is trying to bring something up from the past. The group is part of past people, and there is wisdom from the past. And it's often carried in a folktale. Now, the gestalt of these, the shape of these three things, the parable, the fable, and the folktale, if you hold those, you know, those meanings in mind, you know, each one of them seems to evoke a specific experience or meaning, I'd like you to hold on to that and listen to this phrase. Story at 11. You know what's coming there. Right? You're watching TV and story at 11. Well, you're thinking, okay, yes, it's the news. Pure objectivity. Simple reporting of facts. Well, everybody's smiling, I can see that. Because, you know, you're forewarned right now. You're all thinking about this. And you know that objective reporting has gone the way of military intelligence. But let me point this out, that those reporters have every intention of giving you a story. They have warned you, and it's a promise that they intend to deliver. They're going to give you a story. Now, television is as much of your life as your shoes, I'm sure. This takes some understanding on my part, because as I take every opportunity to tell everybody, I don't have a television. I gave away my television. I was not even 20 years old. I was incensed. I was incensed at some propaganda that was on there, and I just reached behind, pulled the plug, put it in the car, gave it away at work the next day, and I've never had one in my house. I shouldn't say that. My son got upset with me once, and when he was 12, he took a computer monitor and he built a television out of it. So, have had televisions in my life. I never bought one. Right. But television carries stories, and this is not a railing about television, so that's about the last thing I'm going to say. But stories. Stories are powerful. We know this with our mind, with our body. Stories make our minds spin. They make our stomachs cramp. Your body can laugh, cry, tremble from the story. And your mind can dart about with the story, or it can recoil, go into shock, or it can feel at peace. Stories do that to us. Now, stories have this power. And to try to get a grip on them, it's a little elusive. Because stories are so wide-ranging. They do so many things. They come in so many variations, so many forms. But even if you talk about the categories of stories, you've got fables, horror stories, adventure stories. Okay, what is the root? What's the foundation of a story? What is a story? And what does the story do? At its basic fundamental level, you can define a story by saying it's a string of words that do two things. It reveals life as it is, and it reveals life as it could be. Every story does those two things. To reveal life as it is exposes our failures and shows us the wonder. And the revealing of life as it could be, it points us towards hope. It shows a world of kindness, a selfless, caring world. Well, that's just two examples. This is what a story does. It reveals that which is hidden from us because it's constantly exposed to us. Suddenly you can see the obvious through the eyes of a story. Now, that's what a story does. How we react to this new vision is the next subject. How do we react to stories? At our most base level, we learn. This is something you can't help. This is something the way God made you. If a story has got you, you will learn from that story. This is a wonderful thing. And often our society scoffs at the oral tradition, you know, all these primitive societies who pass down wisdom and knowledge from generation to generation with stories. You know, spoken stories, oral tradition. Okay, we're harsh on those people, but it turns out that the practice of oral tradition is, in fact, the best method that humans have for sustaining a society's wisdom. It doesn't require any technology. It never runs out of paper. The photocopier never eats the original. It doesn't go away when the batteries run down. The only catastrophe that can wipe out these stories, this wisdom, would be such a disaster that it would wipe out the society as well, and you wouldn't need it. You would not need it to preserve the wisdom when the society is gone. So it is actually a wonderful thing. And we're beginning to realize now how important and how valuable oral tradition actually is. And when I tell a story, when I have this powerful thing that I am responsible for, I'm not concerned that the child receives the lesson. That's not important. What's important is that the child keeps the story, because that story is a package. And if that child remembers the story, even if the child can't understand any lesson out of it, and carries that story with her, then as the years go by and she replays that story, the wisdom will come out of that story. The lesson will be told over and over again. The story has power, the story has information, the story teaches. New listeners become associated with the story. If you've all heard the fables and think of the fox and the sour grapes, right? Probably one of the most common ones in our society. Sour grapes. How many times have you used the wisdom of that story? And long after you knew the meaning of that story, you would hang wisdom on it. A story is like a tree in the landscape of your mind. It bears fruit over and over again. When you go to that story, it's going like going to a tree, and it's always got fruit for you. And when you have new wisdom, you go to that tree and you hang that wisdom on that tree, on that story. The plane of your mind is filled with these stories, like trees, like a forest. Now, stories can be the foundation of our lives. And if you think about it, and you think about your life, what do? You think about the story of your life. You can't escape stories. And, sadly, stories can be used for less noble purposes. Stories can cause you to be unhappy. Stories can make you depressed when you have no reason to be. Stories can make you displeased with the luxuries that you've spent all your money on. Stories can make you hungry when your tummy's already full. We call these stories commercials. The power of those stories is very well understood by the advertising community. What if everybody ate just enough? How much money would food chains lose if everyone in North America just ate 2,000 to 3,000 calories a day? It'd be disastrous. Bad news. So they hire storytellers who create stories to show us the obvious. And these are the guys who do the advertising. What do? They reveal the world as it is, and they reveal the world as it could be. They reveal the world as it is, a plain, simple, obvious truth. Food tastes good. They reveal the world as it could be. That tasty food could be in our mouth. And people learn from this story. They trot out and they go buy that food, and even though they're not really hungry, oh yeah, they drive in. They go through the drive-thru. They eat it anyways. Stories are powerful. I have to cut this short because I could go on about how we find ourselves in stories. I could go on about the characters, how we identify, how we see ourselves, how we see our lives in stories. It's a complex topic. Universities offer advanced degrees in storytelling. And curiously, if you Google for these advanced degrees, you will also find side-by-side advanced degrees in advertising. Storytelling. Now, the title in the bulletin for this message was War and Peace, The subtitle didn't get put in. I told Andre that it's War and Peace, shorter than the original book. And this was just a preamble. The actual message is much shorter. The actual message is indeed a story. And now that you've been warned, now that you know what stories do, and those two things, they tell life as it is. May not be exactly as it is, but it's supposed to bring out, because of the differences, it's supposed to bring out the stuff that's always around us, that's become invisible because it's always there. It's like a highlighter on a textbook. The text's there. Why do you use a highlighter? What? Because when you paint over it, next time you flip over that page, spring, up comes that line. That's what a story does to life. Let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, long ago, there was an old teacher. On a sunny summer morning, the old teacher sighed. He was cleaning his paintbrushes, and as he put them away, he looked at his morning's work. It was an oil painting of a fruit bowl. And even though he would have to admit it, that he liked painting, and he did it every morning now that he was retired, it was a terrible painting. Oddly enough, he would also have to admit that the painting made him happy. He didn't mind being a bad oil painter. He enjoyed the act of painting, the feel of the brush on the canvas. It was nice. And the paintings were horrible. But, you know, if he kept at it, he just had to get good at it. It was hard, but he would work at it. He didn't mind that, because in his life he had enjoyed great success. He was a teacher of many, many students. He had taught children writing, he had taught children math, he had taught children honesty and integrity, and in general, how to live. Many of the children had done very well when they grew up. And they had all grown up now that he was old. Some had become famous, many had become rich. One had even become the king, although he couldn't take credit for that. It just happened when the old king died. Yes, his students had all been children once, but now they were all grown, and the teacher was old. And he hadn't talked for years. He lived alone with his garden, a few pets, some chickens, and he was enjoying his remaining years in retirement. Even his lack of success at painting failed to dampen the joy he found in these peaceful years. And sometimes his old students would visit him, and they'd have a wonderful talking about their times as teacher and student. And once a year, he would always get a card from the king, which he appreciated because he knew the young king was busy learning how to be a king, running a country, and he appreciated the time that the king would take to write a card to his old teacher. One day, there was a knock at the door. The teacher was surprised to find a soldier there. He thought it would be the postman. And the soldier said, "I have come from the king. He has a message. He needs you." The old teacher put down his brushes, went to his room, got out his case, put a few things in it, closed the case, walked to the door and said, "Let's go." He climbed into the cart behind the horse, and the soldier and him drove off through the dust. And days later, he arrived at the palace. The old king had made the country rich. He told his merchants to concentrate on two things: weapons and medicine. And the factories complied, and they became very good at that. The swords made by the kingdom were the best. It was said of those swords that they could even slice through swords from elsewhere. You could be invincible with a sword like that. And the bombs made by the kingdom were legendary. A bomb just big enough to be carried by a cart with two horses could be pushed off. The cart could run away, and when the bomb exploded, it could destroy an entire village. Just one bomb. The people who developed their weapons did their job well. The kingdom also sold medicine. The medicines were amazing. Nowhere else could such cures be found. People would travel for thousands of miles to buy these medicines. Thusly did the kingdom prosper, whether it was war around them or pestilence around them. The kingdom always made money. As a result, many of the smaller countries around them hated them. They hated the kingdom because the kingdom would sell them weapons, but they'd also sell their enemies weapons. They hated the kingdoms because when the kingdom had these medicines and they needed them, the kingdom always charged them money. They hated the kingdom. And, as will happen, they would occasionally mount attacks on the kingdom. The king had no choice but to order his armies to fight back. He had invaded a few of the small countries, trying to subdue them, but like trying to squeeze a wet watermelon seed. The harder he would fight, the more he would lose control. The king hated war, but he couldn't stop fighting. Thusly he called the teacher. And when the teacher arrived, the king explained the situation, and the teacher said, "Why did you get me to come here all this way in person for such a simple thing? You could have just asked for a letter. I could have told you what to do." The king said, "Well, please tell me. I don't know. What is it?" Well, the teacher told the king his simple plan. It was a plan that would cost the country very little money and very few lives. It was indeed a simple plan, and the king, after hearing it all, simply rejected it. "Your plan is very cute," said the king, "but it will not work. I need a strategy that can give me a quick victory over these small countries that plague me. I need to win." Well, the teacher said, "I'll tell you what, let me think about it. I'll come back and I'll see you tomorrow." And so the teacher went to some rooms and he thought about it. And the next day he came back to see the king. And the king was sitting in his study, surrounded by expensive things. And on his lap was his favorite cat. The teacher walked into the room and he said, "I have a gift for you." The king said, "Yes." And he held out a box. The king, sitting, stroking the cat, was watching. And rather theatrically, the teacher opened the box. The king looked. And out of the box sprung a little mouse, crawled up the sleeve of the teacher, looked around, thought he saw some freedom, and jumped off, hit the floor running, ran around in circles, trying, looking around, ran here, ran there, and finally ran to the wall, ran along the wall, found a little hole, and was free. The king looked. The cat barely looked. And the teacher closed the box. The king said, "Well, what was that about? I thought you were going to bring me a gift. A mouse? You brought a mouse as a gift? I don't get it." And the teacher said, "The gift is a lesson. Can you tell me what the lesson was?" The king said, "Don't take the lid off a box if there's a mouse in it? Mice are small? I don't know what." The teacher said, "Here's your clue. What did the cat do?" The king said, "Not much." He held up his favorite cat, obviously well fed. That's your lesson. The king was no dummy. He said, right, I see. This lesson has to do with the plan you gave me. All right. Is your plan going to work? And the teacher said, my plan cannot fail. But just to make you feel better, why don't we do this? Why don't we just follow my plan for a year? The king said, fine, we've been fighting these countries for dozens of years. Fine, we'll go with your plan for a year. And they started organizing. The king had to get soldiers who were volunteers for these special missions. They had to develop special wagons, which were extremely fast, which you could push a large box off the end very quickly. And in the darkest of night, teams of these soldiers would race out of the country, go to the small countries, and thunder through villages in the dark, dangerously through these rough roads, stop in a village, and before anybody could attack them, they would push the box off the back, jump to the front of the cart, and drive away as fast as they could to save their lives. And this went on throughout all of the countries that surrounded the kingdom. At first, the villagers would run, terrified, out of the village, fearing that a bomb would explode and destroy everything. And after a while, they had to come back, and some brave soul would open up the box and find inside clothing, food, medicine. It's a trick, they said. It's a trap. The medicine's poisoned. The clothes, there's something wrong. There's something wrong. But eventually, people would use it. It was there. And it was free. And eventually, people started to expect these things. The middle of the night, they'd hear the carts thundering along the road, and they'd run out into the moonlight and look for gifts. And eventually, the kingdom became safe. Because the lesson of the cat and the mouse was, why should a cat jump off of a comfortable, warm lap to chase after a mouse when he's already fat and full and fed? Why are these countries like cats pouncing on mice? Why are these countries trying to destroy the kingdom? Because they're hungry. They're poor. The lesson of the teacher was followed, and the king eventually did win. He didn't win victories, but he won peace. In his reign, he became known as the King of Gifts. And as the teacher left, the king said to him, thank you for your help. The country's safe. I would never have believed that such a simple thing would work. What are you going to do now, O teacher? And the teacher said, I'm going to go back home and do something difficult. What's that? He said, I'm going to become good at oil painting. Now, you'll all take that story with you, and you'll all do something with it. You can't help but do something with it. And that is my gift to you today.